The scripture reading from the Old Testament this morning is from the book of Isaiah, chapter 40, verses 3 through 8. A voice cries out, "In the wilderness prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be lifted up, and every mountain and hill be made low. The uneven ground shall become level, and the rough places a plain. Then the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all people shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. A voice says, 'Cry out!' And I said, 'What shall I cry?' All people are grass. Their constancy is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades, when the breath of the Lord blows upon it. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever." The New Testament reading this morning is from Luke chapter 1, verses 8 through 15. Once when Zechariah was serving as a priest before God, and his section was on duty, he was chosen by lot, according to the custom of the priesthood, to enter the sanctuary of God and offer incense. Then there appeared to him an angel of God standing at the right side of the altar of incense. When Zechariah saw him, he was terrified, and fear overwhelmed him. But the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah, for your prayer has been heard. Your wife, Elizabeth, will bear you a son, and you will name him John. You will have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth, for he will be great in the sight of God."
Zechariah gets the first angel visit in the Christmas story, but how many are there altogether? Six, yes. You do have to combine the accounts in Matthew and Luke to get there. So let's add them up. The two final angel visits are warnings to the Magi and to Joseph, warnings about Herod. The Christmas story is nearly over. The Holy Family has been through one heck of a time. The strange visitors are leaving. They're finally going to get some rest. And then an angel shows up and says, "Flee to Egypt." That's what he tells Joseph. And then says to the Magi, "Go home another way to escape Herod." So those fifth and sixth angel visits are cautionary commands. All creation is singing praise to this monumentous baby, but you need to lay low and keep him safe. Herod, the current Roman-employed king of Judea, waits for the Magi to report on the baby destined to be king of the Jews so he can kill him. The Magi sneak home, and then Herod attacks full scale, killing all baby boys in Bethlehem. Does that story ever undermine Christmas morning for you? As you sit around the tree, maybe you're watching the fire. In my family, we would read that story before we got to open our presents. The story unsettles me. It's the same ploy used in all action movies. You get attached to some main characters, and all these minor characters are dying off, so it builds the suspense and then builds the relief when the main character survives. I don't hold Star Wars accountable, but this narrative in Matthew is disturbing. But let's keep counting. Angel visit 4 is the one we sing about the most. An angel finds the shepherds tending their flocks by night, and tells them who this baby is and where to find him. And then a whole multitude of the heavenly host appears and sings these shepherds toward Bethlehem. So how many angels are in a multitude? The Greek word for host is stratia, and that refers to the stars of heaven. So there might be as many angels in a host as there are stars in the heaven. One of the treasures that we've found in Huntington, especially out Cold Springs where we live, is the thousands upon thousands of stars we get to see at night. And this is a multitude of those, a multitude of hosts, multitudes of thousands. So clearly there are more than six angels in the Christmas story, but still six angel visits. Angel visits 2 and 3 are much quieter. One angel visits Joseph, one visits Mary. It could even be the same angel, because in Luke we read that the angel of the Lord, Gabriel, visits Mary. In Matthew we read that the angel of the Lord, unnamed, visits Joseph. This angel, or these angels, come to Mary and Joseph to let them know that this child living and growing inside Mary is God's work and that all will be well. You've heard about these angels countless times. But there's one more, the one that Belle read for us this morning. Who receives the very first angel visit in the Christmas story? Zechariah. So Elizabeth and Zechariah are one of those couples facing infertility in the Bible, like Sarah and Abraham, Hannah and Elkanah, or Rachel and Jacob. Elizabeth and Zechariah wait years and years for a child, and they end up with a child who will change history. In fact, miracle conceptions, miraculous because of fertility challenges or virgin status, are a classic starting point for somebody who's going to be a big deal. If you read the Bible as literature, you pick up on these archetypal themes. It's an excellent plot device. But if you read the Bible as pure fact, you can see God likes to bring significant leaders out of unlikely circumstances. And you can read it both ways all at once. The Gospel of Luke doesn't simply open with a miracle birth story for the heck of it. Elizabeth and Zechariah create John, who we know as the Baptist, and he paves the way for Jesus' ministry. When Mary visits Elizabeth, both pregnant with their significant sons, John stirs in Elizabeth's womb as he senses Jesus is nearby. Just like Mary and Elizabeth, Stone Church is giving birth to a new thing in this time of pastoral transition as we continue to welcome new people who shape the identity and the purpose of this body. It takes parents, shepherds, magi, and at least six angels to get Jesus safely into the world. It takes all of us to bring Stone Church's next chapter onto the page. We each have a part to play in this narrative that is unfolding before our eyes in this very moment. Just like John the Baptist, we prepare the way for Christ's love and justice to be born into this world, not just one Advent season, but again and again. Just like Mary and Joseph, Elizabeth and Zechariah, we might be mystified by what is happening within our own bodies, within ourselves. And like these parents, we must sacrifice as we sign on to God's plans for us, letting go of control, or like parenting teaches, letting go of pretending like we had control in the first place. The best lesson that I get in letting go of control or my pretense of control is going to sleep. The Centers for Disease Control know that insufficient sleep is a public health epidemic in our country, contributing to car crashes, industrial disasters, medical and occupational errors, as well as chronic diseases like high blood pressure, diabetes, depression, obesity, cancer, general increased mortality, and reduced quality of life and productivity. Yikes. So how many of you got enough sleep last night? All right. The Geneva Convention considers it a war crime to deprive somebody of sleep, but most of us do it to ourselves on a regular basis. We're born good at sleeping. Many of us lose that skill as we age. Usually when we practice at something, we get better at it, but sleep is different. We start our life sleeping like cats, maybe 16 hours out of each 24. By our first year, we're hopefully still sleeping about 14 hours, then down to 12 hours by age 3. During elementary school, we sleep 10. Then as teenagers, we're supposed to get at least 9 hours. Throughout adulthood, The recommendation is 7 to 9 hours, but few people pull that off routinely. And then as we age, we tend to sleep even less. In fact, there's this myth that older adults don't need as much sleep, but that's not true. It's just harder and harder to achieve those 8 hours with changing hormones, more trips to the bathroom, and a life's worth of stresses to think about. Theologian Frederick Buechner writes, "Sleep is a surrender, a laying down of arms. Whatever plans you're making, whatever work you're up to your ears in, whatever pleasures you're enjoying, whatever sorrows or anxieties or problems you're in the midst of, you set them aside, find a place to stretch out somewhere, close your eyes, and wait for sleep. A surrender." But the surrender is the struggle. The older we get, the more we unlearn surrender, especially in a culture like U.S. America, in which individualism, accomplishment, long to-do lists, and ruthless striving are the keys to the kingdom. Surrender and rest are demeaned as weak, lazy, needful. But our faith heritage gives us the gift of Sabbath. From the very beginning, according to that first origin story in Genesis, God blessed the seventh day and hallowed it, resting from all the work God had done in creation. Ever since, we have been trying to cultivate Sabbath in our own week. From the strict clarity of no work, no cooking, no driving, no writing in Orthodox Jewish Sabbaths, to the slower pace of life focused on socializing and prayer that Muslims observe on Fridays. And then our own ways of spending Sunday afternoons, taking naps, choosing not to spend any money, dwelling at a leisurely meal with people we love. It's not anchored in the Genesis story, but Buddhists also observe upasatha, which is a weekly time of cleansing the mind and finding inner rest and joy. Sabbath's first gift is rest. Most of us are sleep deprived, emotionally drained, overstimulated, overstressed. So taking a day or even part of a day for rest is a relief. Underneath the rest, we find spiritual wisdom. By avoiding work on a Sabbath, we relinquish control. Any of us who have achieved some measure of success by our culture's standards have done that with projects, plans, programs that we are busy juggling. If we step away for a moment, the balls would crash down around us, right? But if we step back and disentangle from the daily grind, and I know some of you do this as a spiritual discipline already, if we choose to take a day of total Sabbath, we have to step away from the juggling. And then someone else might get a chance to spin those balls back up to the sky. Or we might find that some of those balls, those projects, plans, and programs, can hover on their own for a while. It's not comfortable, but it is a gift to release control. And then the next layer of uncomfortable blessing is what we should do with that free time. Do you spend your Sabbath time sleeping, reading, vegging out, going for a walk? What is it that you do when you choose to do nothing? Kids are experts at Sabbath, and they're usually expert sleepers. I think it's because they're closer to trusting, to utterly trusting, that someone else will take care of them. Because it wasn't so long ago that they lived inside someone else's body, that they ate from someone else's body, that they were totally dependent on other people for everything. As babies, we could trust our hearts to keep beating, our lungs to keep filling, just as we trusted the adults around us to hold us when we cried, feed us when we were hungry, help us get dressed or get clean, to hold us and keep us warm. And inevitably, the adults around us let us down. Inevitably, we learned that our bodies are vulnerable. The older we get, the more we know that people fail, that our bodies fail, that we will fail. I started having insomnia when I was about 9 years old, Somehow I thought that if I maintained a vigil through the night, I could keep people safe, mostly my dad, who traveled a lot for his work. I still resist falling asleep. Now I usually do it with a screen, thinking that I have to have just a little more fun, because don't I deserve to relax and finally have some fun? But of course, it's really not that fun, and then I feel lousy the next day. But my insomnia has a different nature now than it did in earlier times of my life. I used to lie awake rehearsing conversations in my mind, preparing for whatever stress I thought the next day would bring, whatever conflict or challenge was waiting for me. I would practice what I would say, how I would deal with it. I never do that anymore. I gave that up a few years ago, thank God. And it is about God, at least in my journey. It's about trusting that God is present with me in my sleep, in my waking, even if I do not wake up tomorrow, that I will be in God's presence. I got to this trust when I noticed how many joyful, profound moments I've experienced on a day after barely any sleep. Because in the last couple years of my worst insomnia, the thought that would keep me awake more than any other was how terrible I would feel the next day, how foggy my brain would be, how I wouldn't be able to do my work well if I didn't fall asleep now. Of course, that kept me awake longer. So when I realized that the beauty and blessings of my day were not dependent on how much sleep I got, that I hadn't earned them, that they came regardless of my sleep or not sleep, I learned a little better how to surrender. Sleep is a total equalizer. No matter how much or how little money we have, no matter how loved or despised we are, we all need sleep. Some of us can sleep well on a corn husk bed. Some of us cannot sleep on the fanciest king-size mattress. But all of us on a regular basis must fall asleep. All of us on a regular basis get to fall asleep. It's tempting to make our Sabbath lofty and fancy. Who wouldn't be able to enjoy Sabbath on a Caribbean vacation, lying in a hammock? But what about simple Sabbath in the midst of our lives, our homes, here? Can we find ourselves enjoying the moment just in the midst of the day-to-day? Maybe that's enough, most days, just to tune in to the moment. And then each night we get this chance to practice again. Could each night's sleep be a moment for Sabbath, a holy pause from work, from striving, wishing, or regretting, a nightly giving up control, letting go? God birthed Jesus into this world through Mary's labor. What is God birthing into our world through our labor? We've been looking to Mary for advice this Advent about co-creating with God. We're learning from one of the oldest ways to co-create with God, creating a baby. People and the divine are both required. It might not be written that way in biology textbooks, but I don't think any of us would be here without divine inspiration and design present in that initial attraction, the desire, the conception, and the gestation of new life. Sleep is another way we co-create with God, especially in our dreams. Dreams are essential to our health. While we dream, we store memories, we work through conflicts, we regulate our mood. And I'm not talking about analyzing the stories or the symbols in our dreams and looking for insight. Just the act of dreaming gets all that done. The memories, working through conflicts, regulating our moods. It's done at a time when we're most vulnerable, sound asleep, surrendered, but we're still at work co-creating with God. I don't know that God puts dreams in our minds. I haven't taken that to be true in my life, but if you believe it, that's great. I do think God designs us to dream, designed our dreaming to work on us while we rest. Most of us work hard to make this world a better place, serving on committees, showing up for community events, sharing our money with Heifer International and the food bank, being kind to each other. We work hard because we believe that Jesus, that God calls us to continue the work of Jesus peacefully, simply together. We want to be of good use in making God's vision for justice and peace a reality. And still, we are designed to spend at least a third of our life asleep. A third. That's so much time we're losing. Time we could spend working for justice, serving our neighbors. But God designed us to sleep. And we're not just lying around. We're still at work, co-creating with God. I hadn't planned to talk about dreams when I wrote the title and the blurb for this sermon. I was going to tell you about midwives. I was going to talk about Shifra and Puah in the first chapter of Exodus. It's a great story of insurrection in the service of life, so you should definitely read it later. But then last week, I had a dream that Ben Latimer, one of your new pastors, was showing up all over Stone Church. He was at all the meetings and gatherings, and we kept laughing when we would run into each other because we aren't supposed to be overlapping here. I did wonder where Cindy was, but the dream really was a sweet one. I smiled when I woke up. I was baffled, but I enjoyed that soon and very soon, Cindy and Ben are going to be around every corner you turn in this building. They're going to be in this pulpit every Sunday. They will be with you. And it reminded me, do you remember of those dreams I had in August before Christy left? I had three of them, totally unpleasant dreams, where I would show up here on a Sunday morning, but the building wasn't the same, and the people didn't look familiar. The sanctuary was laid out all wrong. And each time I would wake up from those dreams, I would feel so relieved because I knew that whatever stress and sorrow we were living with as we said goodbye to Christy, we were still the same Stone Church, always changing, but we would never lose ourselves overnight. I don't spend time analyzing my dreams. It's appealing to me, but I'm not a morning person. I don't want to work that hard after I wake up. But every once in a while, I have a dream that helps me articulate something that's been just under the surface, lurking in some corner of my mind. So my cheerful dream about the Latimers coming to be among you got my brain spinning. And then, last week, one of you told me a story that you had dreamt about Christy and that she was so happy, and you woke up knowing that she is all right. Then a few days later, another one of you told me about a dream that brought you to this whole new insight about yourself and that you think you're going to change careers. And then yesterday morning, seriously, one of you told me that you dreamt about your attic being designed differently and then you remodeled it according to your dream. I'm not telling you who because I didn't get a chance to ask permission. So do your dreams mean something to you? Philip used to tell me that he didn't dream at all, but I think I've convinced him that he does. He just doesn't remember them. Because truly, all of us dream. If you sleep deeply, you will dream, and if you aren't sleeping deeply, you cannot survive. Even without remembering our dreams, they work on us, storing memories, helping us work through conflicts, and regulating our moods. Some researchers say that the majority of our dreams are negative, scary, or at least unsettling. And those angel visits to Zechariah, Mary, Joseph, and the Magi, they are all at least unsettling, if not terrifying. So I'm not talking about dreams this morning in some touchy-feely, warm, fuzzy way. I hope you do get a lot of those dreams, though. I don't know if God sends you specific messages in your dreams or if God just designed us to dream and the rest is mystery, but I do know that God's creation has no waste, none. I'd like to wish you a farewell blessing that your dreams would always be sweet, that angels would only bear glad tidings of great joy. But we know that kind of blessing would be shallow and impossible. Your bad dreams, your good dreams, the third of your life you spend asleep, are never wasted. They are all opportunities to co-create with God. As you let yourself relax into bed tonight, as you put away your phone or your book and turn off the light, invite God to be part of your sleep, your dreams, your sifting through this day that you have finished, and let God prepare you for the day to come, and then surrender. Amen, and sleep well.